Welcome to another episode, another week of the Young Turks, starting without music. And I'm gonna be honest, I'm getting off on the wrong foot there.
Yes. Just,
it's not exciting. Not
music's important, you're right.
It is.
Sets a tone.
It is. We'll try to make up for it, I guess, with the stories and our commentary or something like that. But it's not gonna be the same thing. I want music later, damn it. Anyway, I'm Johnny Roll. Michael Shore is here as well. Mark Thompson back in the studio. Always good to have you here. It's been too long. Lots to get
Actually,
to today.
He was just here. It's been
yeah,
too
but
long
John wasn't here when I was here.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I was out the end of last week at a convention in San Diego, but back now, and a lot going on in the world, a lot we're going to get to. Why don't we jump into just a couple of quick little stories, something interesting that happened over the weekend. Last Friday, Donald Trump was talking about May 1st, the so-called Loyalty Day, a day for, quote, individual liberties and individual government. Now, I had not heard of Loyalty Day before, but apparently he didn't actually invent it. It's been around for more than half a century. I don't know that presidents generally talk about it because it has some weird connotations to it. And it might be that that's why he's talking about it, that it, in fact, it is to distract you from the other day that May 1st is. It's not just Loyalty Day, it's also May Day, which is a slightly different holiday, focusing on slightly different values. And as we speak right now, in effectively every major city across the country, there are marches and strikes going on. There's a specific day without an immigrant protest going on as well, because this day is supposed to be focused on the labor movement, on workers' rights, and all that that movement has given to us. Now, we could go on for the rest of the show and longer, just in the US context, and what the labor movement historically has given to us.
We would have had to do a show yesterday were it not for the labor movement.
Exactly, and maybe Saturday as well. And we'd be working much later. The hosts might well be 9-year-old children.
Yeah, definitely.
If not for this. And that, thankfully, that dark future did not come to pass because of the movement that Donald Trump appears to be trying to distract from. So hopefully many of you are participating in the marches, possibly in the strikes as well. Don't allow this day to go by without acknowledging, understanding what has been achieved, sometimes at extremely great cost, at the risk of violence, possibly even death early on in this movement. The gains have been great, the losses were great as well. And just still as an aside,
I was just going to say, as an aside, John, you know, many would argue who are in that movement that there have been a lot of losses in the union movement, particularly in the ability to unionize and the ability to organize.
The ability for unions to raise money.
And through Democratic administrations as well. It's not just a GOP thing. And now, of course, the GOP seems to be including the anti-union rhetoric in their jihad. So,
well, yes and no, because what they've done is they've co-opted a lot of those union workers, and the Trump campaign certainly did that last year.
By getting the focus on non-economic issues,
exactly,
possibly,
and saying that
the trade is a way to sort of co-opt it. Obviously,
absolutely,
he didn't actually intend to fall through on some of those promises.
And in many of those Midwestern states where he did well, a lot of the union people sort of cross in that, what are those Venn diagrams? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of crossover between people who are white male voters in America who are also union voters. So there was a lot of that, and that did well for Trump.
Yeah, and the thing is, typically the unions have gone more towards the Democrats for several decades. But by the same token, and the Democrats want that money because the unions are a large source of campaign donations, but corporations are a bigger source of those donations. And so all too often, as you point out, both parties have been willing to sort of ignore the concerns of the labor movement or actively work against it. It's not been equal exactly, but it's been bad in both cases. And so we can't ignore that as we go forward with the current administration. Secondly, it's actually been a good day for net neutrality because a judge struck down a request for review that had upheld the previous FCC net neutrality regulations. And so we had those regulations protecting net neutrality, protecting consumers from their speeds being shifted based on corporate whims or prices being determined by what corporations want, particular types of material, maybe progressive news shows being advantaged or disadvantaged, had been upheld. There was an attempt to take those down. That has been stopped for now. Unfortunately, in the background, just in the past week or two, actually, the new head of the FCC has begun the process that could lead to a Supreme Court battle over the continuation of those net neutrality regulations. And unfortunately, with Donald Trump getting a person on the Supreme Court rather than someone else having that spot, it is possible that those regulations will eventually be taken down.
We were talking about this on the podcast the other day, the fact that this is a front and center issue.
The self-promotion's unbelievable.
Well, the self-promotion would be if I were to mention the podcast web address, which I don't need to because it's posted here on the screen.
And it says, at the end.
It is occasionally posted on the screen. Yeah. There you go. But the point I'm trying to make is that net neutrality is really threatened. I mean, it is a front and center issue. And it is, I'm not overstating it to say that democracy is at stake, because information is at stake. And freedom of information is at stake. This net neutrality thing is yet another way that media and information is being suppressed, and it seems truly unabated at this moment. I mean, you feel that more and more that those corporate overlords are gathering more and more areas where media is providing information. And net neutrality may be the last bastion of free-flowing information, and it's absolutely an endangered species.
Yeah. And we're in real life talking about income inequality and what a huge problem it is in America. And that is sort of a microcosm, this net neutrality, because it is inequality that would sort of flourish within the world of the internet, which keeps, unfortunately, I think, growing. I've had it with the internet.
Yeah, look, and historically, we have sort of educational inequality based on different amounts of funding going to different schools, people having access to some schools but not others. And we've had that. The internet, what was so revolutionary and amazing about it was that, theoretically, if you have access to the internet and you have the drive and the support, you can help to overcome some of that educational gap between the rich and the poor in America and other parts of the world. But that might be at risk right now.
That's a terrific point. This disparity that you see in education, the inability for people to really have a shot at higher education and ultimately better jobs and control of their own destiny.
And higher wages.
You see that higher wages and better wages that reward higher education. You will then now see that potentially with the net neutrality, with erasing net neutrality. You'll see what John is talking about, which is that, hey, if you're not a rich person or a person who is better able to pay, you will not have access to a lot of the information that could provide for you better wages and a better future.
Exactly. Okay, why don't we turn to some of the big domestic politics stories of the day. Congress has just reached a $1.1 trillion budget deal that's going to stop a looming government shutdown that was possibly going to happen. They'd done an interim one-week budget deal, and now they've got the big one that will fund the government at least until September. You'd think with a dollar value that high, you'd get farther than September, but that's how America works. But interestingly, in this budget deal—
You have to pay the housekeeper, though.
Exactly. Yeah. It's incredibly expensive. But what's interesting about this budget deal is that there's actually quite a bit to like in it for liberals. Not everything. The Republicans do control every branch of government at this point. But the liberals in some ways have gotten more than Donald Trump has. And so I want to break down some of those ways that liberals have sort of won out. I mean, overall, we've got no defunding of sanctuary cities, which is one of the things that Donald Trump said had to be in the eventual budget. We don't have that. Additionally, several hundred million dollars in funding for Puerto Rico's Medicare program. So there was the possibility of that being shut down by lack of funding. He didn't want that to go to them. It is going to them. And then here you have a bunch of other, I mean, these are, we put it in one graphic. But any one of these are absolutely massive differences between the initial proposal from Donald Trump and what we actually get. And we may not like some of the final bill, but in all of these cases, it's better than what was proposed. I mean, look at that overall, 30% cut to the EPA. That's not by chance the first thing. An absolutely massive cut both in dollar value and manpower for the EPA. There will still be a cut of 1%, and understand that theoretically we should be funding it more. So that's effectively a larger cut than what we could have had under a different president. But that allows it to continue in roughly the same form, although with terrible leadership. A 30% cut, I mean, and losing thousands of employees, that fundamentally risks taking away their ability to fulfill their core functions of regulating environmental pollution, scientific research into climate change, and things of that sort.
Yeah, I know it's kind of chic to, in this seat on this table, to sort of, you know, begrudge the Democrats at every, you know, at every turn. The Democratic minority is doing a pretty good job of fending off a lot of this stuff. When you think about Donald Trump, and a lot of Republicans had to come to the table too, who are not crazy about this president. But the Pentagon, He asked for, a $54 billion increase in the Pentagon? He's getting an increase, but he's not getting that much.
Yeah, it's a $12.5 billion with a possibility of a couple more billion dollars.
Right.
It's defense, so why not throw a couple more billion
Right, right. You left off the National Institutes of Health, something that they said they would cut. Not cut. Planned Parenthood.
And additional funding.
Yeah, additional funding. I think that you,
$2 billion,
you have to put, you know, a big Sharpie underline under Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, so I believe that that's up on
there.
And
that was on there.
That was a huge priority. And Donald Trump had pushed for that, but a lot of other Republicans had pushed for it as well.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the reasons I want to focus on that is, so as Michael pointed out, obviously the Democrats are in the minority in both houses right now, fighting to stop some of these changes. But you also had, as you said, a lot of Republicans who didn't want to make those changes, or some of them that might have ideologically wanted to make some of these changes, but they understand the repercussions because we're already racing toward a midterm election. Midterm election typically doesn't go well for the party that just won the presidency. And then when you combine it with the fact that some of these programs are incredibly popular, people love Planned Parenthood. It's possibly the most popular organization of its type in the country right now. They don't necessarily want to be the ones who help to cut it. Cutting the EPA, you know what people like? Their kids not being poisoned by the environment. Cutting the EPA, incredibly unpopular, and it shouldn't
be
unpopular.
You don't even have a kid. I have one.
I don't have a kid. I want my dog being poisoned.
You don't want other people's kids.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. I don't want his kid being poisoned. And so this really speaks to the power of both public opinion broadly, the fact that we know that these programs and these organizations are popular, but also the huge amount of activism that we've had across this country since the inauguration. I mean, we had specifically the Women's March. Planned Parenthood support for that was a big component of that. The March for Science, the climate march that just happened this week. I mean, when you have millions of people in the streets, politicians, even dense, stubborn politicians, they do see that, and that might have shifted some people on the Republican side, and maybe even some libs as well, to not support some of the massive cuts.
Yeah, listen, there was a real groundswell. I'll let you speak in a second, Thompson.
Yeah,
but there was
please,
a real groundswell of people phoning their representatives, going to these town halls, giving an earful, which helped Republicans. I think there's also an air. This is pretty nuanced and it's early, but I think there are Republicans who are weighing how much they want to support this president heading not just towards the 2018, but towards 2020. I think there's a Republican Party that's stronger than people think that want to, that would be fine seeing this presidency end and then moving on to another one. So I think that has a lot. So Republicans, of course, did a lot, and I think these town halls were extremely important.
Yeah, that you make a great point. I mean, sort of the groundswell that they could see in the streets and at the town halls. I mean, it's beyond the presidency, though. The Republicans look at Planned Parenthood and the EPA, and they put a big target on both, I think. Probably bigger one in terms of a target on Planned Parenthood, but this president has put the target on EPA. I mean, and it's a real one. And he has undone already a lot of things, and now he does this, I don't think he does anything. I think he's utterly inept and, you know, crazy.
Right.
He's upstairs watching Fox News or something, but his henchmen begin the process of coring the EPA, and they try to do it with money. So this is a key thing to see that it wasn't defunded in the way that Trump wanted.
Right.
Yeah, and of course this doesn't mean that the EPA is in a good spot. It's led by a climate denier, a guy who fundamentally seems to despise science and all that it reveals about the world. And every week there's another executive order attempting to open up more public lands for drilling and mining and selling off to corporations and all that. So it's still a rough position, but it would have been much worse with a 30% cut. That theoretically they could still sneak in September possibly, but for right now, thankfully it didn't happen. We should also acknowledge he wanted funding for the border wall between our country and Mexico. That is not included. In fact, the amount he wanted extra for border security was halved. They're going to be adding $1.5 billion. And as well, he wanted this massive, almost $20 billion cut to non-defense spending. Instead, they're increasing non-defense spending by about $4.6 billion, which is amazing considering that the party that passed this are the ones of limited government and everything, but more power.
Right. I mean, if you think about the Republican House and a Republican Senate, and this is the budget that a Republican president gets through, that is embarrassing for the Republican president.
But as you said, that speaks to the resistance they're getting politically.
I would imagine so. I mean, that's not overt, but I think it's starting. And I do think that, you know, if you watch Donald Trump on the campaign trail, everywhere you went, I went, whoever went, you heard Donald Trump speak. You heard him talk about Planned Parenthood and this wall.
Yeah.
And the first budget that comes up, nothing. You know, I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Now, of course, look, if you're looking for things to not like about the budget, I mean, the fact that that we're increasing defense spending by another $12 billion when we already have by far the most bloated military budget in the history of the world. That is an insane waste of money, and it's a waste of money with consequences. That money theoretically could go to reinforcing and strengthening the EPA or the NIH or the NSA or any number of other organizations. I mean, we could be putting that into, instead of canceling the Let Girls Learn program, which we're going to talk about in the second hour, we could be putting additional funding to that or other foreign aid projects. There's so much that we could be doing with the money, and instead we're again throwing hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars away at the military. But increases to military spending are just something, at this point, you're going to get that under Democrats, you're going to get that under Republicans.
Yeah, that's a conversation we would have been having, Trump or not Trump. We would be saying,
exactly.
I can't believe
it might have been that large if it was Hillary Clinton.
Right. And, you know, when you hear military, you know, I know that there are these idealized visions of, you know, men and women out there defending our shores. But the truth is, if you really want the wasting of spending, go to the Pentagon. That is one of the most wasteful administrative aspects of Washington life. You can, and the stories of wasteful weapon systems to toilets are epic, right? So when you look at throwing that much more money, and as John says, it could have been earmarked for so many other things, but you just look at it going to this wasteful agency, it really makes you just disgusted with this administration.
But there's no way to look at it as a lib and not say, with a Republican president, House and Senate, that this isn't a better budget than most would have envisioned going in. So
exactly.
They're, you know, the old silver lining.
Yeah. Well, one other little bit of waste, much smaller than the waste that Mark was talking about in terms of the Pentagon, but still annoying, an additional $131 million for Secret Service to cover the president's protection demands. Now, of course, the president deserves and needs protection. They've always had that. He already had that funding. But perhaps if some of his family was willing to live together and didn't need to be hundreds of miles apart, and he didn't need to fly to a resort every single weekend, we could have saved that little bit of money. Maybe that could have gone to
something. Maybe they'll build a country house for him. You know, a place that he can go on weekends that's already got a security apparatus in place that he could get to very quickly.
It'd
on
be like going to camp.
I mean, some place like that existed already.
Yeah, I know. Well, we'll think about
it. We'll look into it. But anyway, that's some good news for you to start off the show. From here on out, it's not going to be as good news. I apologize in advance for that. We are going to take our first break a little bit early today because we got a ton to get to once we come back. Welcome to the first hour of the Young Turks, everybody. John and Mark and Michael. I'm going to be honest, I don't 100% know if I'm supposed to say this since Cenk isn't here. He might feel him stepping on his toes. So that's why I didn't say it at first. But I think it's okay. I just want to acknowledge that apparently, almost objectively, you guys have accomplished more in the first 102 days of Donald Trump's presidency than Donald Trump has. Can we bring up this picture and I'll show you the proof of it?
Well, all they see is us.
There it is.
Oh my God.
Wow.
We did it. Not only did you do it, but you kept going afterward.
Yeah, you tipped them.
Which was a nice feather in the cap there. $2 million. TOTNetwork.com/go. I don't know if you can still donate, but if you can, sure do it. But
and
that means.
Can I say on the behalf of Jesus Godoy, thank you for the $7,666.
Thank you.
He appreciates it.
But that means we get another new hire. I don't honestly even know who it is. I'm not 100% sure that Cenk does because he had a couple of incredibly well qualified candidates.
I know who it is.
You do?
Mm-hmm. But I can't say it.
Damn. Okay, tell me the break.
No.
But then fine. It's going to be announced soon, but that's incredibly exciting because that means that's another person on the beat, breaking stories, investigating what's going on. And we didn't do that here. You guys did that, and that is awesome. It's awesome
it's
to,
really
to come back and to see that.
It's just great.
I don't think that anyone could have predicted that it could have worked, and especially that the last push from 1.75 to 2 million was like less than a week, I think maybe it was a week. That's unbelievable.
Plus, just from a fundraising standpoint, you know, once you've got 1.7, it's very hard, actually. I mean, it gets harder just
to close.
Because
so many people have already
contributed. Yeah.
Exactly.
Sure.
I mean, that's,
so that's a great 56, credit to everybody.
56,000 people have contributed. It's mind blowing. It's once you get into numbers that size.
John, what was the average donation?
The average donation, I'm going to say $27. I honestly don't know. But in addition to that, I do want to read some of your tweets. One of them was related to that. Inge Smith said, I'm proud member, proud to be even non-American donor of the 2 million the hashtag TYT Army put together, proud of everyone. And we're proud of you guys as well. Sabrina Hartman said, John Arola, Mark T. Live, and Michael Shore, an hour one on a Monday. I was not prepared for this. So excited with a smiley. So thank you for that, Sabrina. And so both El Duende Chingon and Rafer Madness are totally right. So El Duende Chingon says, a half a kick to the nuts is still a kick to the nuts. Don't be fooled. Rafer Madness says, I'm wary of calling the maintenance of the status quo a, quote, victory. The status quo was drowning the majority of people. Push change. You're both right. And that's what we said at the end of the video, is that there's still tons of money being thrown into the military and a million other priorities that should be going in the opposite direction. We shouldn't be cutting the EPA by 1%. We should be doubling its funding and giving it more authority to go out and regulate more emissions and things like that. I totally agree with you. But this could have been much worse.
Right. I mean, you have to sometimes, you know, be celebrate congratulatory of good defense wherever you're getting it
from. Right.
And, you know, this is goes to, I was going to mention this in the last segment. I'm glad we came back to this, because it goes to Trumpian politics as they are, which is he views everything as a negotiation. So he kind of wants us to sit here and celebrate the fact that, you know, hey, it's not as bad as that first pass. Yeah. Although, frankly, so much of his image, which is what he cares about more than anything, was associated with that first budget proposal that was thrown out there, that in a way I think we can celebrate legitimately, because I think he
Or you can do both at the same time, celebrate and wish for more.
Sure.
It would have been great if Hodor had been able to turn around and punch all those zombies out, but he just held the door, and that was enough for now, at least.
I'll laugh like I know what you're talking about.
You don't watch Game of Thrones?
Serious question, though. Donald Trump, victory for him? Or, I mean, you don't need to boil it down. Is he happy about what's going on with this budget, or is he not? What would you guess?
He might well not know what's going on with the budget. Oh, I don't know how much. I'm not even joking.
Correct answer,
I don't know what I don't know to what extent he's following.
You can watch Fox News, and you'll find out whether he's happy or not. Yeah, if they're happy, then he's happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, not, shortly thereafter.
Yeah. Right.
But I do want to recognize a couple of the members. David Brown and Barbara Bogard, thank you for being members of the Young Turks, incredibly important to us. And maybe one last round of the donors who got us not just to 2 million, but beyond 2 million. There was $27 from Ian in Louisiana, $27 from Maria in Connecticut, my home state, $50 from Courtney in California, and $100 from Freddie from Texas. There's also the possibility that these were read on Friday, but they're double reads. And thank you again for your donations. I actually don't have room for that. But with that, we should jump back into the news. Earlier this month, or last month, I guess I should say, the New York Times pissed off a lot of people when it decided to hire Bret Stephens to write articles for them. Now, he is a longtime climate denier and conservative that they pitched as a different sort of voice, that this was about diversity of opinion and all that. I guess he denies the climate in a different way than other Republicans, perhaps. But anyway, people were mad. And now his first article has come out. We have had access to it. We've read it. And people are even more mad, because the New York Times said that, look, we get that you're mad about this guy, and he goes against 97% of all the climate scientists in the world. Doesn't seem to have any credibility on this issue, but whatever. We'll have him, but we're going to fact check him. Okay, so if he makes a claim, we're going to fact check it. Well, they didn't actually do that, because he got a lot of fundamental facts stated in. He only stated a few facts in here, and he got them wrong. We're not going to break down all of them, but we do want to read a little bit of his article, because the core argument I find not just offensive as someone who believes in science and its ability to reveal truth in the world, but for someone who cares about climate change and our attempts to fight it. So Bret Stephens said this. His article, by the way, is Climate of Complete Certainty. He said, claiming total certainty about the science traduces the spirit of science and creates openings for doubt whenever a climate claim proves wrong. Demanding abrupt and expensive changes in public policy raises fair questions about ideological intentions. Censoriously asserting one's moral superiority and treating skeptics as imbeciles and deplorables wins few converts. And he's very worried that there are not going to be enough converts to people caring about climate change, I guess. Now, he says after that, none of this is to deny climate change or the possible severity of its consequences, but ordinary citizens also have a right to be skeptical of an overweening scientism. I think there are a lot of isms going around that we should be worried about it. Scientism is not the one that I think that we should be the most worried about.
You're censoriously traducing that. So just stop.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Okay, if you want to imply that someone's
overwritten-ism is something that I'm worried about in this culture.
Yes. Now look, there he's saying none of this is to deny science. And I get why he's saying that, because he is a longtime climate denier, and he's worried about possibly losing his job. So he wants to pitch himself now as what he calls a climate agnostic, as if one should be agnostic about whether our civilization is on the brink of destruction or not. But anyway, if you go back and look at his history, Vox had a couple of good quotes that they compiled. Stevens has previously called climate change a, quote, mass hysteria phenomenon. I've heard that before recently on other issues, for which, quote, much of the science has been discredited, and he as a scientist would know. He said that people who accept climate change science are motivated in part by a totalitarian impulse, and they worship a religion without God. So that's not just climate denial. Yeah, and additionally, he said global warming is dead, nailed into its coffin, one devastating disclosure, defection, and reevaluation at a time. If that is not climate denial, climate change denial, I don't know what is at that point. To say that it's dead and buried, and then, you're just an agnostic about the most important issue facing humanity right now. So that's his position. I don't like the framing that scientists are absolutely certain about anything, when science, if anything, and especially scientists in the modern day, are marked by like this. It's drilled into you when you're in, like I was in academia, not one of the hard scientists, it was a social science, but that you should constantly question yourself, that you're constantly testing other people's hypotheses. Even if something seems to be shown by the data, it is continually retested. There is a humility that no other field, first of all, is demanded of them, and second of all, that they take upon themselves so willingly as science. And so to pitch it that they're absolutely certain about anything is 100% untrue. I don't know why New York Times didn't do their quote fact checking there. Now there's a little bit more to it, but I want to give you guys a chance to comment.
Well, first of all, just on that, science, ironically, there's an evolution in the way people think about science, yes. Even scientists, which people should think about. Also, Bret Stephens won a Pulitzer Prize when he was with the Wall Street Journal. And the letter that was written to the Pulitzer Committee by the editor at that time, maybe it was Paul Gigot was the editor of the Wall Street Journal at that time, their editorial page, sent that letter to the Pulitzer Committee, did not cite any of his, anything that had anything to do with climate change that he had written. He'd written a sheaf of pages on climate change, did not use any of them. So the Pulitzer Committee never saw any of his work on climate change. The Times hired him to do this, and it is it's such a departure from the way that most of their readership and most of the country thinks to go at science in that way. It's the Times really has to rethink the way that they do this, because it's like talk about fake news, right? I know it's an op-ed and it's opinion and all that, but it's fake news, and the Times has been fighting against that label for so long.
And they've thrown their weight behind it. I mean, this is a much advertised position that the Times is now representing. When the truth is, John really stated it so well that the facts are the facts, and there are certain facts that are not in dispute, and then there are certain facts that are being revised constantly as they are disputed by new facts that come in. All the graphs on the warming of the globe are undeniable. I mean, they're right there. It's such a steep curve up that to deny that would be crazy. Then you get into how much of it is man-made and how much of it isn't. But again, the science community is replete with examples of award-winning scientists, all of whom think that this is a man-made event.
Yeah.
And so, is it provocative and cool to take it on? Because I suppose that's
but why is it?
No, that's the part of this party that he's occupying, because there's no substantive part, factual part of the party that he's occupying.
Yeah, he didn't even cite an example of this supposed complete certainty.
Yeah.
That's the whole article. There's no examples given of scientists showing complete certainty.
And part of what he talks about, too, which is ironic considering he came from the Wall Street Journal, right, where they don't criticize anything having to do with Wall Street, generally speaking. That's not true, but thematically they don't. He's saying that there's a moneyed part of this, that there's a moneyed interest in going, out and saying that yes, there's man-made climate change. It's a huge problem, and then that's to open up the coffers of money.
Yeah.
And Stevens is critical of that after having been at the Wall Street Journal for such a long time, where the rest of the world is criticizing the way that Wall Street operates, and now they're just going to go after scientists for saying they're in it for the money. Well, that's what's unbelievable. When people criticize journalists and scientists for being in it for the money. There's no patience for that.
They apparently haven't worked as one of those things.
Yeah, apparently not.
Those aren't big money industries, no.
Exactly. And to the Pulitzer, look, you can do great investigative journalistic work and be absolutely crazy on other issues. And this is not journalism. This is at best an op-ed that's poorly written and poorly researched. Now, it's just one. Maybe it'll get better. But anyway, and to say that that his main concern is that those scientists are so sure of themselves, and that's why they're saying we should spend an extraordinary amount of money, that we should damage the economy and limit growth to stop our hundreds of millions of people potentially having to flee rising ocean levels. He believes that. Okay, well, first of all, many people believe that investments in clean energy, renewable energy, and things like that could actually be a net positive for the economy. He simply asserts that it's a negative without providing evidence for it. Again, that wasn't fact-checked by the New York Times. But I've actually seen a big meta-analysis of the expected, if we were to pursue policies necessary to keep global increases in temperatures from going above 2 degrees Celsius extra, that it would limit growth globally by 0.06%. And for some reason, they can simply say it limits growth to scare people. Mm. I would easily give that if it means that we don't potentially have to face worldwide droughts and famines and things of that sort. But there's one other thing I want to show. Another meta-analysis. If we're talking about certainty and we're talking about what scientists think is likely to happen, the book Climate Shock had this chart. Now, this is an accumulation of a lot of analyses of what the expected warming is and the likelihood of it happening. And so you're seeing there, there's no chance that we're not going to go up almost 1 degree Celsius, okay? Now, we've already had since the 1900s, I believe, somewhere between 0.6 and a little bit more than 1 degree raise in temperature. Now, there's a very high chance that it's going to be either 2, 3, or 4 degrees. That is a disaster by itself. You're looking at ocean levels going up. You're looking at some cities becoming uninhabitable. You're looking at some crops not being able to develop. That is a disaster. But then once you get towards the right, there's a very large chance. Look, they've marked it off. More than a 10% chance of more than 6 degrees centigrade of warming. That is species threatening potentially. Now, if there was a 10% chance of you crashing your car if you got into it, would you drive? If there was a 10% chance that in a routine surgery you were to die on the table, would you get that surgery? No, at the very least, you'd get some insurance. And yet he looks at that sort of information and says they're too sure of themselves. I would say both the scientists and those of us who care about the continuation of our civilization are being far too timid. And yet he's the one getting paid at the New York Times.
And by the way, the coda to that is that they've historically been on the timid side. You know, all the forecasts about how warm the planet will get, you're constantly seeing we're getting warmer at a pace that's even faster than those projections. And you've been seeing that story over and over and over again for the last decade. So I think the scientific community is timid about making these alarmist forecasts.
Yeah, because because unfortunately this particular area of science has become incredibly politicized, and when they come out with their findings, they're either censored by the government, they're attacked by politicians and by pundits because they don't like what science has revealed. I would say if you don't like what it's showing, then enter a doctoral program, conduct research of yourself, have it go through the peer review process, and show that those other scientists are wrong. That's how you actually prove a point, not simply attacking them and asserting that some guy who went to school for 12 years at the doctoral or the graduate level is doing it for the money when he makes 50K a year afterwards.
Right.
Anyway, we're unfortunately gonna have to throw to our second break. We're gonna try to make it short, come back, and cover as much as we can with what remains of the first hour. We'll be back in just a few. Welcome back, everybody, to what remains of the first hour with Mark and Michael and myself. We've got some tweets I want to read. Let's see. Tom Sherry says climate change isn't a debate. It's been proven by climate scientists because don't you believe in it doesn't matter. Well, it's on Twitter, so it's a little bit messed up, but I get your point. And look, if anyone figures out that the data was wrong, and that it actually isn't happening, you know who's going to figure that out? It's going to be a scientist, okay? That's how it works. It's not going to be this dude at the New York Times. I would like to read more, but unfortunately we're running a bit short on time today, so I'm going to jump ahead to the next story. Donald Trump's first 100 days in office have been marked by some successes for him, admittedly, but failures in getting the passage of a few of his most high-profile and most anticipated pieces of legislation. And that has not been lost on Donald Trump, who is responding to these setbacks by questioning the fundamental checks and balances that have been a hallmark of our system of government since its founding, for the most part. We're going to go through a few of his quotes recently, because he was interviewed by Fox News, and that's where he was questioning some of these continued distributions of powers, checks and balances, and all that. In this clip, you're going to see him talking about how archaic these rules are.
I think more than anything else, I'm a person of common sense. I understand what has to be done. I get things done. I've always been a closer. We don't have a lot of closers in politics, and I understand why. It's a very rough system. It's an archaic system. You look at the rules of the Senate, even the rules of the House, but the rules of the Senate and some of the things you have to go through. It's really a bad thing for the country, in my opinion. They are archaic rules. And maybe at some point we're going to have to take those rules on. It's not fair. It forces you to make bad decisions. I mean, you're really forced into doing things that you would normally not do except for these archaic rules. So,
like what? How would you change them?
Well, you know, you look at the voting and you look at the filibuster system. I think, the filibuster concept is not a good concept to start off with. But if you're going to have filibuster, let somebody stand up for 20 hours and talk. Decisions that nobody wanted are made because of archaic rules. And that's something that I think we're going to have to change.
You mean the archaic rules that created the electoral process?
Exactly. He likes that one. The one piece I agree with him on is that I do think that if you're going to filibuster, you should stand. I think that it should go back to that traditional way. I think there's a lot of benefits that would
come from
that.
That's the only thing he knows about the filibuster.
That is true.
He saw Mr. Smith goes to Washington on a plane once.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with anything. Yeah. He has no idea. He was saying he learned that the Senate has archaic rules, right?
He just
learned
about it.
I don't think they're archaic. I think they're arcane, but that might be a totally different thing. I do think, though, that he had no idea. We know that. He had no idea how any of this
works.
He didn't want to win. He didn't think he was going to win. Now he's here and he's got to criticize something. Well, it takes a long time to get something through the Senate, which is designed to be the greatest deliberative body in the world, right? I mean, that's just how it works. And it's frustrating at times. But this guy is so clueless and so inept and so unprepared for this job.
And so not, first of all, he said that he's a closer, which apparently he's not based on the first 100 days.
Right.
But then also, I'm a man of
common sense. He's not an opener either. By the way, apparently.
Exactly. No, he opens by grabbing them. But anyway, look, he said there, the arcane rules force you to make decisions you never would, that you don't want to make. But what does that mean in practice? What that means, and he's talking there about the filibuster and the need to get at least some of the other party, as the distribution stands right now, onto your side, that means making decisions that aren't 100% abhorrent to half of the country.
Right.
Or honestly, more of it, because of the ridiculous, arcane way that our system is set up, you can get far more than 50% of the vote in Senate races, as the Democrats did, and have less than 50% of the representation. That also is the case in the presidency. It's also the case in House races. So he seems to be benefiting and he doesn't mind too much about those sort of archaic rules that lead to them getting disproportionate influence in the legislative and executive branches of government. But he doesn't like the one that forces you to at least have a veneer of bipartisanship and get a few people to cross over. And understand his frustration with the fundamental checks and balances in our system, he's frustrated with the way it works when he has a friendly Senate and a friendly House.
Right.
Even then, he's not willing to accept what every president in American history has had to deal with.
Yeah, he's got most of the cards on the table, and he's still unable to accept trying to get a consensus on certain things. And that's what you're seeing him resistant to. This guy doesn't want to build a consensus on anything. And if you look at what he has done, and I think he's done a lot of damage in his first 100 days, it's all through executive order, it's through executive fiat, it's through the King Trump that he thought he would be.
Yes.
And now that he's running into some things that the King, can't legislate by himself. He refuses to look at the consensus building as anything but archaic.
Right. And going back to archaic, well, it is archaic, but going back to archaic, you know, he wants to be royal, right? Yeah. Nothing in America is more archaic than royalty. And that's kind of how he's wanted to govern. And it's dangerous, man. Yeah. But I don't think it's so dangerous because I don't think he's going to be able to do these. You know, he's not going to change the rules of the Senate from the White House.
Look, McConnell talked a little bit about the possibility. He says for right now, he's not interested in eliminating the filibuster for legislation, but he's already the guy that was in charge when the nuclear option was used.
Right.
There's a precedent for him eliminating the filibuster, and McConnell would like it as well.
And if Anthony Kennedy gets a cold, you're going to hear McConnell in a totally different way talking about how he would change the rules. And, and whether they're archaic or not, it doesn't matter. That's sort of the structure of it. I don't think archaic has to be a criticism all the time.
Well, to get back to just the way that we elect
presidents. Yeah.
Elect the president. I mean, that's
the best point. You know,
that's the cornerstone of archaic and ridiculous. That is, I think many would agree, that's a bad system, the Electoral College. We talked about it before the election.
I've even defended it at times. And this election proved to me, not because of its result, but because of the way it got there to that result, that we don't need the Electoral College anymore.
Yeah. But you don't see, as John says, you don't see Donald Trump taking that on because that's what he rode to power on. He's a guy who is not interested in consensus. He's not interested in compromise. It's his way or the highway. Or as I said before, he doesn't even know what he wants, but his henchmen and those who are a little more informed, because he's inept and completely uninformed, whatever they want, it's their way or the highway.
There's one other aspect of this. So here we have the possibly substantive power grab to shut down these checks and balances theoretically in the legislature. But it's also for Trump much more petty than that, the failures of the 100 days and what it's leading him to do. So back during the campaign, he talked about opening up libel laws. He said this, one of the things I'm going to do if I win, and I hope we do, and we're certainly leading, I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposefully negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws so when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, I don't know what that means, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money instead of having no chance of winning because they're totally protected. So he said that back in, I believe, June of last year. I love that after all this, he's focused on the fact that he can make money out of it. He's not even saying just if they write something that's false, which is what libel laws are there for. He says if they write something that's negative, we can shut it down. Well, you might say, John, you're going crazy. That's way back in the primary. Now he's presidential Trump. Well, unfortunately not. Let's play this next video.
Change the libel laws. That would require, as I understand it, a constitutional amendment. Is he really going to pursue that? Is that something he wants to pursue?
I think it's something that we've looked at, and how that gets executed or whether that goes anywhere is a different story. I think that newspapers and news agencies need to be more responsible with how they report the news. I am so tired.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Everyone, it's about whether or not the president should have a right to sue
them. And I already answered the question. I said this is something that is being looked at.
And so still, and this is 100 days after the inauguration, they are still looking at possibly stopping media outlets from writing anything negative or critical of the president. Yeah. They have that in some countries around the world. I don't think we want to be more like those countries.
Reince Priebus is like the coach of the Browns, right? It's like, I can't believe this is my job. I can't believe that. You know, it's like, what did I do? Spicer, but Spicer does. I think that he's a more thoughtful person than Spicer. Yeah, you may be right.
Right,
yeah.
But it's true. If Spicer had a smarter kind of more contemplative kind of older brother, it would be Priebus, right? So he goes out there. What you see in Spicer is the young kid who's like just trying it out. How did that sound?
This is neat.
Right.
Yeah. It was fun being the rabbit. Now I can do this. Okay, one more story for you. Back since fall of last year, we've been following the ongoing activities of a class action lawsuit against the DNC by a number of people who supported Bernie Sanders, donated money to Bernie Sanders, and feel that they were in effect defrauded because they gave that money to Bernie Sanders feeling that there was an open and free and fair and impartial primary system. They feel like the revelations of what took place during the primary show that that's not the case, and thus they gave money under false pretenses. Now, this court case has been ongoing, and thanks to TYT Politics, they've uncovered the court transcript of one of the most recent hearings has been posted on a PAC's website. So we now have some arguments being made by the lawyer for the DNC that are at the very least quite interesting and worded in a way that I wouldn't have gone down this direction. But we're going to read some for you. First, and this is from Brad Spiva, a lawyer for the DNC, saying, "There is no right to, just by virtue of making a donation, to enforce the party's internal rules." We're going to return to that. "And there's no right to not have your candidate disadvantaged or have another candidate advantaged. There's no contractual obligation here." But it goes beyond just that general argument. There's an example given. Brad said, "But here, when you have a party that's saying, we're going to, you know, choose our standard bearer, and we're going to follow these general rules of the road, which we are voluntarily deciding, we could have, and we could have voluntarily decided that, look, we're going to go into back rooms like they used to and smoke cigars and pick the candidate that way. That's not the way it was done, but they could have. And that would have been their right, and it would drag the court well into party politics, internal party politics, to answer those questions." Now, the reference there to enforcing the party's rules is because there's concern that the DNC was not abiding by their rules to be impartial in the primary process. This comes from the DNC Charter, Article 5, Section 4, that says, "The chairperson shall exercise impartiality and even-handedness as between the presidential candidates and campaigns." And people cite a number of different instances in which the former head of the DNC, W. Wasserman Schultz, fairly clearly was not impartial, was not even-handed, and we can disagree on the extent of how much this actually mattered, worked to advantage one candidate who shall go unnamed over another. Oh, just no.
Well, for, I think when it comes to, I turn to Michael because I always feel like on politics you really have a vision of this situation.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. We've talked before about the fact that the Democratic National Committee is, it is a cabal in a sense. A lot of stuff is pre-decided, and they, in a way, get into a room, maybe not literally, but maybe literally, and figure out who the best candidate to put forward is. There may be no sin in that because they are trying to tactically agree as to where they should apply their strategies. But I turn to you because whether or not this is an actionable thing, I think it's creative.
If you're the lawyer in that case for the DNC, that's exactly what you're going to say. I mean, I didn't have a real problem with anything you said until he got to the impartiality of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because she clearly wasn't. And if that's what you're bound to be, then she wasn't. And
I wouldn't have said the part where, like, if we wanted to simply go in a room and choose the nominee, that's our right. I think, well, especially considering the political context going on right now.
But isn't it the right?
The Republicans could literally have done that.
Yeah.
I know, I'm saying I think they could. The Democratic Party, like every political party, is a private organization. They should change their charter if they're going to go in that direction. They could have done that. I would not pitch my argument in that way, I would say.
I see what you mean.
I think that's
just illegal.
He was being a lawyer there
by saying,
we can even meet in the back of a car somewhere and make this decision.
Right.
Yeah. He's trying to make an extreme.
And like when George H.W. Bush was running in 88 and then 92, Pat Buchanan challenged him in 88. The Republicans behaved exactly the same way. And of course, you don't want to always compare yourself to your opponent. But the party politics stuff, that's just going to happen. And maybe they should change it. It's a product of the duopoly. And I'm not just sitting back here and saying it should go on that way. Mm-hmm. But clearly, this is a lawyer trying to find the best way to win a class action lawsuit. And I'm not
irked
by what he's saying, even the stuff that I disagree with.
Yeah, we have to acknowledge it's a lawyer. It's not an actual member of the DNC.
Yeah.
He says there that he doesn't believe that it was rigged. You can disagree with him, but that's what he's saying. I think it's clear that if you're going to have a claim to impartiality, you cannot. I mean, look, everybody in politics is connected in various ways. If you've been in DC for a number of decades, you're going to know people. But certain people being the head of the DNC during a primary seems like a bad idea when they have a clear history with certain candidates. I would not go in that direction again. Now, it's frustrating. I don't like the way they're pitching this. I think that it's short-sighted. I think that I don't know that necessarily those trying to get the money back have much of a case because donations are donations. But I think that they're digging the hole even deeper here. Now, some people have gone farther and tried to say that this is the DNC admitting that they rigged the election. I'm not sure how you derive that from this actual quote. Maybe it feels good to say that or to think that that's there. But I think that this is a horrible direction to go in. I think, again, it's the lawyer, it's not them. They're not necessarily in charge, but they need to avoid these sorts of things if they're going to reaffirm to people that there's actually the possibility of positive change in the party's future.
All right, but here, let me play devil's advocate for a quick second on that. I mean, they probably would say, hey, look, by this lawsuit, by this class action, we're going to expose or re-expose or enter into the discussion once again these flaws in this party. And this, there's no question that the party political system is flawed, and they would say, and these flaws need to be addressed. And if we need to address them in this awkward, ugly way, then we'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. If you're going to give $100 to Bernie Sanders and you want him to be president, and then you find out that he isn't where you are on a certain issue, you can't go after Bernie Sanders and say, wait, I want my money back. I mean, in a way you can, and sometimes campaigns do give money back. But I feel like this is really all about the legalese. And this, you know, class action lawsuits are usually brought by opportunistic lawyers, and it's probably a lawyer fighting against an opportunistic lawyer, another opportunistic lawyer.
Well, I mean, look, TYT Politics did an interview with with that lawyer, and I mean, the rhetoric coming out of him is that this is fundamentally about how you conduct a democracy, how much ability people have to actually get the candidate that they want. And so I do think that we should be very concerned with that. There's a lot, as Donald Trump says, there's a lot of archaic rules, not just in the US government, but in the parties. And I think that all of those theoretically can be looked at. And in some cases, like with the parties, I mean, we're not in the smoke-filled rooms anymore. But in some ways, perhaps we haven't come as far from those rooms as we should. And there's still time to change that. Anyway, there's a lot more that I wish that I could say on this story. But we are out of time, unfortunately. Thank you to both of you for joining me. It's always great to have you back in the studio. Doesn't happen nearly enough. We're going to take our break. When we come back, it's going to be my think tank co-host, Hannah Cranston, is going to be leading the second hour. Brett Ehrlich, Francis Maxwell as well. A number of awesome stories are going to break down the second hour. We'll see you in just a few.
Except for Brett, that sounds great.